Dangerous dossiers. When I was a young teenager in the 1950s, I remember going to a neighbor's house because my father was the last on the block to have a television set. He was waiting for color. So I went to a neighbor's house, and they had on these hearings in this little black and white television set. I say little. The screen was little, but the television set was huge. And there were boring hearings. They were the McCarthy Army hearings. And I said, what's this all about? It was beyond me. But then, of course, I came from a conservative, Middle Western Republican family from Kansas. And so when McCarthy was on, I don't think my father would complain too much. He was an oil man, a businessman, very conservative. So I grew up in a household where there wasn't very much political activity. We didn't think very much about it. My father did have the great books, however. He had a huge set of the Reader's Digest condensed books of the time. That was how literary my household was. So I grew up kind of immune. Also, the 50s, they were vivid in many respects with the red witch hunts. But at the same time, toward the end of the 50s, things seemed to get benign. All during this period, in the 40s and 50s, of course, as you point out in Dangerous Dossiers, the federal authorities were keeping files on, I guess, just about everything. So tell me a little bit, why don't you set the stage a little bit to tell me why the government keeps dossiers to begin with?
Well, the government, and specifically the FBI, though other intelligence agencies were involved, including those from the armed services and the CIA, kept dossiers on a number of authors, artists, musicians, because they thought they were subversive members of the Communist Party, with poor associations, enemies of the state. Some of them were considered really criminal. And partly this was because of the tradition that went back to the Palmer raids in the early 1920s and the Red Scares after World War I. And that was just about the time that J. Edgar Hoover became the director of the FBI. As a result of that, he became, as the years passed, actually paranoid, according to some of his closest associates who left later. And then as the Cold War exacerbated and developed, he then became even more rabid in his pursuit of enemies of the state. What surprised me is that the enemies of the state turned out to be the great icons of American literature.
But how many people escaped having federal files on them? I mean, outside of writers, I mean, of course, you're focusing on writers, and of course, you also have some musicians and artists, but doesn't the government keep files of just about everybody in one form or another?
Well, I think they have, and that is why there was a Privacy Act passed in the wake of the Watergate hearings, Senator Church Committee, where they felt that Americans had a right not to have a dossier kept on them. And that's why I call the first chapter in the book The Right of Privacy. I think that we don't know how many files are being kept on people besides those, but there were mail watches, they took down your license plate, and it wasn't just famous people. It was people who were suspected of signing petitions during the Vietnam War, and as the revelations that came out in the last few months, there were even nuns and sisters who had participated in Central America humanitarian aid, non-political, who had files kept on them. That wasn't just in the Hoover era, that was in the Webster era. That was a shock to most of us.
It's almost amusing, and I suppose that's not the best phrase to use, but it's almost amusing when you read in your book the files of certain people, and there would be lines, unsubstantiated, of course, from unknown informants saying something to the effect, he has leftist tendencies, or he is a left leaner, or communistic tendencies. I mean, what does that mean?
It doesn't mean a thing. A dear friend of mine, and you're a mystery and thriller writer yourself, and was Rex Stout, who was president of the Authors League and the Authors Guild, and dedicated so many hours of his life to the betterment of conditions for authors in general. And Rex, who I was honored to serve on his committees, Rex was described as an alleged radical. Now, I don't know what an alleged radical is. And that was the specific description. One of the interesting dossiers in the book was on Archibald MacLeish, who was helping to write speeches for President Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of State, head of the Office of War Information, very distinguished man. I forget how many Pulitzer Prizes he won for poetry and theater. And his people during World War II were being attacked. Some of them were poets when they tried to get them in the OWI and the Office of War Information. And he wrote a letter to the Secretary of State saying, "Will you get J. Edgar Hoover off my heels? He is mixing up ordinary liberals with communists, and he doesn't know that if somebody was opposed to Franco's Spain during the Spanish Civil War, that he was on the right side because Franco is now helping the Nazis."
Well, you have included in Dangerous Dossiers my libertarian friend H.L. Mencken, but was Ayn Rand, you didn't ask for Ayn Rand's file, did you?
No, I didn't.
That'd be interesting to see if they built one on her.
I had to stop after about 100 because some of these files took 2 and 3 years of waiting to get them and repeated appeals for me to cut out the blacked out stuff. And I include some of those actual censored pages in the book. No, I didn't ask for Ayn Rand. I didn't ask for a lot, although I did receive some files that I didn't include in the book because I just had to stop somewhere. I do have 6 Nobel laureates.
Yeah, you have many of the great writers. How did you decide to pick these particular names?
Well, I thought I'd go after the big ones first. Hemingway, Faulkner, Thomas Mann, Pearl Buck, and I thought that these were the people that we all study in high school and college and read today. All their works are still in print. And if they had dossiers, why, surely lesser people had them.
Goodness, Truman Capote.
Yes, Truman Capote. And I have a whole chapter on the playwrights, the great playwrights, whose work is still seen all over the country. Thornton Wilder, Tennessee Williams, and played on radio and television. And these were the great people and of our time, and they had dossiers, some for their associations. Truman Capote went to Russia with the Porgy and Bess Company. He was being tailed there for reporting for the New Yorker. A lot of it was, I think one of the main points I try to make in the book is that after examining 100 dossiers of writers and playwrights and artists, not one of these people ever spent a day in jail or was even indicted. So this was a huge waste of treasure and manpower by the FBI.
Yes, although Hammett was in jail. I guess it had nothing to do with the FBI, though, did it?
No, Hammett was in jail because he had been on the board of directors of a committee to aid refugees, Spanish War Relief. Yeah. And he refused to give the names of some of the fellow trustees in the office, so he was held in contempt. But it was for nothing more than that.
How do you go about getting a file? I know under the Freedom of Information Act you're allowed to do it, but, I mean, what do you do? Do they give you a form, or do you have to write? How's it happen?
Well, here, since I've been wrapping the FBI in some of its procedures, here I'll compliment them for briefly by saying that I think that under the Freedom of Information Act, they have been very diligent and sincere, even though it has slowed down during the Reagan administration. You write away to the FBI on the Freedom of Information Act, give a description of who you want, mention that he is deceased, mention that you are have a reputable purpose as a historian or an author, and then you sit and wait. And you eventually the documents arrive, or you're told that there isn't any on someone. They do arrive in heavily censored form.
Do you have to pay for the service?
That's an interesting question. Because of the law, you do not have to pay for the service unless the pages exceed around 200 pages. So, and many of these documents on these people did go over 200 pages.
Now, you have photocopied a lot of these documents, and they're printed here in the book, but some of them are just unreadable. There's black marks all over them.
Well, you know, you get to interpret some of those because you put it up against other material that you know. You put it up against biographies. And they do give, there's a little code next to each reason why these dossiers are blacked out. Exemption 1A or 6C. And after you've gone through tens of thousands of pages, you get to know what these codes signify. Incidentally, in every case, I then appeal. They do have a good appeal process, and quite often I would get additional pages. The only material that they would never give up was the name of an informant. But after all, this was being done by clerical people, and some of them were may have been a little too diligent. So on appeal, I would also get extra pages.
But some of these, the explanations they gave, like in the interest of national security, but you're talking about a file that might be 40 years old. I mean, what security implications would there be in a file like
well,
that?
Well, once you're in a file, you never get out of a file. And there were cases here of authors who were dead for 20 years, like Thomas Wolfe. The file was kept up on him for the crazy reason that some of his great novels were being read in school, yanked off the bookshelves by complaints. This wound up in FBI files because he was considered subversive. In the case of Carl Sandburg, for example, I edited Carl Sandburg's letters, and I got to know him fairly well. And he was in his 80s and living on the goat farm down in Flat Rock, North Carolina. And he was very much retired and in his last years. And they were watching Carl Sandburg's writings, what he was saying, and some of his outrageous remarks. He loved to needle the government, was no friend of J. Edgar Hoover. And as a result of that, the files were kept up on this man.
What do you suppose the government, or I hate to use the phrase government because I had a feeling that these files were kept up because of the political beliefs of a few people within the government, such as Hoover and a few people who thought like him. But what do you suppose they intended to do with these files? Round up people and send them to concentration camps in Iowa?
I think that what they wanted to do with them was indict them and find out if they were spies and find out if they were harming the United States government, working for Russia. These were victims of the Cold War, and the Cold War, as we know, didn't start with Winston Churchill's speech in Fulton, Missouri in 1945. The Cold War actually started, in my opinion, right in 1918 and 19, right in the heels of the Bolshevik takeover of the Russian Revolution. And that's how those red raids started in the 1920s. And it wasn't. The United States was probably the last major power to recognize the Soviet Union, that it actually existed, and that happened in 1933 under President Roosevelt. So these people the government was watching them as basically as possible subversive who were spying for Russia. They never proved it by any of these people.
But those people, some of them were like Hammett. He was a radical. Helaman was a radical.
Yes.
Left. Whether they would ever be described as subversive, I mean, I don't think there's any evidence of that would be the case. But many of the people in here were simply liberals. And in effect, if you divide the country in half, liberal and conservative, I don't know if you can divide the country evenly, but say, any liberal would be suspect under this philosophy. Isn't that true?
Yes, it's true. And very often it went deeper than were you a liberal. It went to the heart of their writing. And that's the point that I found most offensive, where suddenly the FBI becomes a literary critic. And because of what you write, even in fiction, this is what happened to John Steinbeck. The Grapes of Wrath was considered a subversive novel because it was on the side of the migratory workers, Henry Fonda playing one of them, and the Okies going out to California during the Depression. It was one of the seminal novels, and one of the reasons why Steinbeck undoubtedly won the Nobel Prize in Literature. There are documents in his file saying that The Grapes of Wrath was a subversive book. There are even more outrageous examples, which were very personal to me, that I mention in the book. I was an army correspondent with Klaus Mann, Thomas Mann's son. Thomas Mann's great novels, The Magic Mountain and the novella Death in Venice, were burned by the Nazis in Germany. He became a refugee and American citizen in 1944. Klaus and I were in the army together in Italy. While Klaus was in American uniform, and so was his brother Golo, his father was being watched. His mail was being watched. This refugee from Hitlerism was considered a possible subversive.
Are they still doing it?
I think they are still doing, and that was the revelation in the last couple of months about anyone who went down to Central America and looked in, including journalists, including novelists, including just people who dropped in on the war for one reason or another, plus 100 different organizations, including non-nursing order, including Civil Liberties Union, including America's Watch, including people whose names are in the paper every day as interested in our foreign policy. They were being watched by the FBI in the last year or two. The same thing happened with the group of people who were protecting people who were on the run from Mexico, refugees there, and who were being protected by the church. They were, I forget
the name.
The name.
It's close to the tip of my tongue.
There's a good name for it, yeah. And maybe we'll think of it. But they were being protected by the church. They were being
sanctuary?
Watched. Sanctuary. Yeah. The sanctuary movement. That's right. Who were given sanctuary by the church. They were being watched the present day. Now, I doubt if it's anything like this. And you are not watched specifically because you're an author or a musician or a writer of any kind or what you paint as an artist. It comes in through another method, because of a petition you may have signed or because you have visited a foreign country or because of your associations with a certain group. So they get you in a different way, not as an author specifically, not as an artist specifically, but because of associations. And are the invasions of your right of privacy.
I don't know if this is equatable, but I do know that they keep files on people who have made, who are suspected of being a threat to the president. And sometimes this is paid off for them. You know, for example, if the president visits Seattle, they know all of the people who have had death threats and things
area,
like that.
Yeah.
Now, that is not a bad thing, is it?
No, I think
these are probably psychos anyway.
Those are Secret Service, and that's a perfectly legitimate operation. A lot of it is legitimate at the present time. Anything having to do with terrorists who seem to be floating around the world, who are some of them armed, that is undoubtedly a legitimate function. But there are other cases where which have nothing to do with terrorism. There is, for example, an edict which has offended many of the librarians and the American Library Association and publishers, where people were being watched for what books they were being taking out of the library, which might have had themes connected with terrorism or certain foreign countries or Sandinistas, and a signal went out to librarians to reveal the names of some of the people who took out books. The librarians would not do so.
Yeah, they shot that I think
that's a pretty private invasion to find out what you take out of the library. That's between you and the librarian.
The FBI have a file on you?
They might. I've written a way to see. Yeah. I haven't heard from them.
Well, anybody who has a byline in the New York Times is suspect.
Possibly. I hope that many of them are not suspect. Some of the great people like James Reston and Russell Baker, who's thrown lots of needles at the authorities. That's one of the strengths of his column.
I'd like to see Russell Baker's file.
I do know this. My friend Bill Malden, the great cartoonist, two Pulitzer Prizes, the moment after some of the background of this dangerous dossiers appeared in excerpted form in the New Yorker last October. He calls me up and says, "You want to see my file?" I said, "You can't have a file." 207 pages kept on Bill Malden, which he obtained about 10 years ago. And in that file, the FBI clipped some of his cartoons. I reproduce one in the book. Imagine sitting there in Washington, clipping Bill Malden's cartoons, which everyone sees in the paper. Some of them were attacked the House on American Activities Committee. But there were other reasons for Malden's file. One of them, he was involved in a group at Peter Cooper Village, Stuyvesant Town, to allow blacks to get into the housing project after World War II. We were both on the same committee. This was being reported and turned up in his file. Now, everyone assumes now that fair housing, even in the fanciest neighborhoods from Greenwich, Connecticut to Palm Springs, California, it's now assumed that there's equal housing. It's against the law not to have it. But at that time, that turned up in your file.
That's a disgrace. I did interview Penn Kendall a number of years ago when he did his book called The File. I noticed that, I guess you talked to Penn, and he's been redeemed. I hadn't followed this up, but I read in Dangerous Dossiers that
just a couple of months ago, just before, while I was finishing up the book, Penn Kimball was able to get not an apology from the FBI for 40 years of maintaining a file on him that utterly changed his career and damaged him. He was unable to get in the Foreign Service. He was a Marine captain, but that file was still with him. And a lot of it was so full of errors, and he started to wonder, why am I being turned down for some of these jobs? And he was an old colleague of mine in the New York Times, and then became professor of journalism at Columbia, now retired. Well, he's a tenacious fellow, and it also harmed his means of making a living and jobs he applied for. He went through the court system, and after about 10 years of trying, finally got an admission that there were errors in his file, and the file was expunged. He is the only American that I know who devoted so many years of his life, took it to court, and was able to get not an apology, but a correction. Incidentally, all those legal fees, there was no way of recouping them. He invested them all in his own time and money. Could have been written a couple of other books.
Well, Herbert Mittgang, I don't know whether to be amused or indignant, because so many of these files are absurd. At the same time, and you laugh, at the same time, you can't understand why they were doing it, except that it was a reflection of that scary period, that it was the tenor of the times.
It was the tenor of his times, which extended from the 1920s and then strongly right into the Eisenhower era in the 60s, and but then went over also in the 70s during the Vietnam War. Of course, many of the people in that period are still alive, and I am positive that anyone who signed a petition against the Vietnam War, who was on a program against the Vietnam War, and this went right across the country and every campus and 250,000 demonstrating in Washington, I am certain that those people had files kept on them. In fact, I know so because I went beyond these files and saw other documents. I was allowed to see them in certain areas in Washington on grounds that I would not reveal them. I was allowed to read them in government offices, take notes, but I was not allowed to reveal the source. And I was amazed at how many people and organizations, living authors, living artists, ordinary citizens, were listed in government documents. Yes, you're right in saying you don't know whether to be amused or outraged. So I think it's a little of both.
Whatever happened to all those communist front organizations of the 30s, 40s, and 50s?
Oh, they're dead. They're dead. You know, I don't even know.
Were they actually communist front organizations? They may have been, but I mean, I just don't even know the purpose of their existence.
You know, there was a Daily Worker and a New Masses, and there was a daily newspaper that was right on the stands. And people were writing for them, and that was the Communist Party organ. And tell you the truth, I don't even know whether the Communist Party still exists in this country.
It does. They're running a woman as a candidate.
I guess they
do. I can't
do,
remember her name, but she's on WMCA a lot.
She's going to get less votes than
Gary
Hart.
It seems to me that we're in although with Nice, it's kind of difficult. You know, Nice has kind of backed off a little bit since he's so close to being indicted. But, you know, for a while he was captivated by closing down pornographers, you know, putting pressure on the these chain stores not to carry Penthouse and Playboy, you know, really going after pornography or what he thought was pornography. But in general, you can say almost anything that's outrageous. Even the FCC allows it. I mean, I heard Howard Stern on an FM radio station the other morning doing 20 minutes on masturbation. And so now it seems to me you can write anything as outrageously as you wish and say anything and belong to any group that's ridiculous and without much fear of punishment. Isn't that true?
I'm delighted to see that there are constant battles against obscenity, and yet there are still books being banned. and pulled off shelves. Judy Blume's novels for young people are constantly being, because they talk about real issues. Huckleberry Finn, to this day, is being pulled off the shelves or censored. Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five was actually burned. So a lot of the criticism of books still goes on. But yes, I think you can say almost anything, because the courts, despite Attorney General Meese, and as of this moment, he's still Attorney General, despite Attorney General Meese's drive against obscenity, I think that the Supreme Court itself has not gone that far in trying to suppress statements under the First Amendment. And it's all been a rather liberating function, because as Jimmy Walker said in a famous remark, nobody was ever raped by a book. You now see nudity on stage and kind of accept it, and you can put nudes on the stage and the play can still flop. It still has to be a good work of theatrical art. So you have a greater openness in the country, a greater freedom, and it's right there in the First Amendment, allowing those freedoms to exist.
It was always there, it's just being interpreted more liberally.
No? Yeah. One of the, of course, a lot of my book has to do with the Fourth Amendment, which is the right of people to have privacy in their own homes against intrusion. Now, why did the Fourth Amendment, why was the Fourth Amendment written and adopted by the states? Because they had the experience of British bayonets. The colonists had the experience of British bayonets coming in and disturbing them in their homes. Now, people like Justice Brandeis came along and, using that same Fourth Amendment, extended the theory that you didn't want a British bayonet knocking down your front door to meaning you didn't want your telephone wiretapped. There were no telephones and there were no wiretaps in the 1770s. But yet, it was the exact same principle, the right to be let alone, in the wonderful phrase of Justice Brandeis in the case I talk here, the Olmstead case.
Well, Herbert Mittgang, you've given us a lot to think about with Dangerous Dossiers, and certainly one thing that you did is to put J. Edgar Hoover in an extremely poor light. Of course, his reputation has been, over the years, extremely tarnished, as we found out exactly what he was doing and what kind of person he really was. So you've given us a lot of information that I never thought about before, and it is scary, but I also want to laugh at it a little bit. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.